contains approximately 4 blocks of protein. 6 ounces of fish contains approximately 4 blocks of protein. 2 cups of raw vegetables contains approximately 1 block of carbohydrate. 1 piece of fruit contains approximately 2 blocks of carbohydrate. 1 cup of cooked pasta, beans, or rice contains approximately 4 blocks of carbohydrate. If the thought of weighing and measuring all the food you eat, or even reading food labels, makes you groan, don't worry. You can formulate a zone favorable meal just by using your eyeballs. Although not as precise as my macronutrient block method, with time and practice, your eyesight can become a pretty good calculator. Start with the protein, using the palm of your hand as a guide. The amount of protein you can fit into the palm of your hand is usually 4 protein blocks. That's about 1 chicken breast or 4 ounces of sliced turkey. The size of the protein on your plate will help you determine the size of your carbohydrate portions. If you're eating favorable carbohydrates, then the size of your carbohydrate portion should be about twice as big as your protein portion. If you're eating unfavorable carbohydrates, make that carbohydrate portion the same size as your protein portion. If your protein source is low fat, then you can get the rest of the fat you need by adding some salad dressing or a small amount of mayonnaise or eating a few olives. Now let's put it all together. The rules of the road are simple. 1. Know how much protein your body needs. Never consume more. Never consume less. 2. Every time you eat, try to make sure you maintain a 1-to-1 ratio of protein to carbohydrate blocks. 3. Spread your protein requirement throughout the day. 4. Never let more than 5 hours pass without eating a zone favorable meal or snack. 5. Make your protein choices low fat. 6. Make your carbohydrate choices from favorable carbohydrates. 7. Make your fat choices from monounsaturated fats. 8. Try not to eat more than 500 calories per meal or 100 calories per snack. As with any technology, there are some hints that will help you reach the zone. 1. If you don't build a meal with a precise ratio of protein to carbohydrate blocks, don't panic. You're only 1 meal away from the zone. 2. Remember, this is not a calorie deprivation program, but an eicosanoid control program. 3. Your goal is to spend as much of your time in the zone as possible. 4. Always drink at least 8 ounces of water or sugar-free decaffeinated beverages with every meal or snack. 5. If you find yourself hungry and craving sugar or sweets, you probably consumed too many carbohydrates during your last meal. 6. No matter how consistently you follow this dietary strategy, you are bound to make mistakes. Now that you know the rules for reaching the zone, you finally have a dietary roadmap for the rest of your life. So bon appetit and welcome to the zone. Up to this point, I've been talking almost exclusively about macronutrients, protein, carbohydrate, and fat. But what about micronutrients, vitamins, and minerals? Virtually all the current research on nutrition has been focused on micronutrients, especially vitamin E, vitamin C, and beta carotene. The truth is that many of the clinical studies using high doses of these antioxidant vitamins have produced mixed results. This is not to say that micronutrients are not important. They are. Certain micronutrients play an important role in a zone favorable diet because they have an indirect effect on eicosanoids. Remember, controlling eicosanoids is what the zone is all about. The micronutrients that affect eicosanoids fall into two classes, antioxidants and enzymatic cofactors. To understand how they help you to get to the zone, we have to talk about what they actually do. By now, almost everyone has heard of the antioxidant vitamins, vitamin E, vitamin C, and beta carotene. These particular micronutrients are ballyhooed in the media as your personal shield against the attack of the dreaded free radical. What is a free radical? Technically, it's just an oxygen molecule with an electron missing. Ironically, you need free radicals to sustain life. Without free radicals, it would be impossible for the body to produce eicosanoids in the first place. It's only when these life-sustaining free radicals hang around too long, or your body produces too many, that they begin to cause trouble. That's why it's important to quench any excess production of free radicals by using antioxidants. But what happens if you have too many antioxidants in the system? You guessed it, eicosanoid formation begins to slow down. The key, then, is getting adequate levels of antioxidants. Where can you get these levels of antioxidants? In most cases, you don't need pills or other supplements. All you have to do is eat zone-favorable carbohydrates, fruits, and fiber-rich vegetables. The one antioxidant that's hard to get in sufficient quantities without supplementation is vitamin E. So this is one of the few instances in which I would recommend supplementation. The other group of important micronutrients are the enzymatic cofactors, including vitamin B6, vitamin B3, magnesium, and zinc. These are required for both essential fatty acid metabolism and eicosanoid formation. Again, you don't need megadoses of these micronutrients, but they must be part of your diet. What are the richest sources of these enzymatic cofactors? By now, it should be no surprise. The richest sources are also the primary components of a zone-favorable diet. As I said earlier, all these micronutrients are important for eicosanoid formation. But in the story of the zone, they remain secondary players. If you plan to get to the zone, then controlling the balance of macronutrients in your diet will be 10 to 100 times more important than the amount of micronutrients you consume. Aspirin temporarily alters the balance of good and bad eicosanoids by shutting down the production of all prostaglandins, so it affects the zone in a crude way for a short time. But your goal is to keep that balance in your favor constantly. That can only be done with food. To understand in greater detail the crucial link between diet and the zone, you should be familiar with the important nutritional code that determines what type of eicosanoids the body makes in the first place. In many ways, fat is a central character in the story of the zone. Remember, the production of all eicosanoids uses as its basic raw material a group of fat substances known as essential fatty acids. These fatty acids must be supplied by the fat in the diet. They can't be made by the body. There are a total of 8 essential fatty acids, which fall into 2 classes, omega-6 and omega-3. Although both classes can be made into eicosanoids, omega-6 fatty acids are the most important for reaching the zone. The eicosanoids that come from omega-3 fatty acids are relatively neutral. To boil it down, the effect of diet on the metabolic fate of omega-6 fatty acids determines whether or not you will ever reach the zone. The production of good or bad eicosanoids begins with the essential fatty acid known as linoleic acid. Linoleic acid is found in virtually every food. In most cases, the higher the fat content of the food, the higher the linoleic acid content. Once linoleic acid reaches the cells, it needs to do a lot of growing before it can be an eicosanoid. The first step in this process takes place when a key enzyme converts the linoleic acid into a more metabolically activated fatty acid known as gamma-linolenic acid, or GLA. The first step in this process takes place when a key enzyme converts the linoleic acid into a more metabolically activated fatty acid known as gamma-linolenic acid. The richest source of gamma-linolenic acid is human breast milk, although trace amounts can be found in one other common food, oatmeal. If the body is not making enough activated essential fatty acids, such as gamma-linolenic acid, there is no way to make enough eicosanoids, good or bad. Of all the factors that influence gamma-linolenic acid production, perhaps the most important is diet. There are three ways that diet can adversely affect gamma-linolenic acid production. The surest way is to eat a high carbohydrate diet. Another factor that can slow down gamma-linolenic acid production is disease, especially viral disease. The final influence on gamma-linolenic acid formation is stress. The body reacts to stress by producing elevated blood levels of the hormones adrenaline and cortisol. Elevated adrenaline decreases gamma-linolenic acid formation. To sum up, maintaining adequate levels of gamma-linolenic acid is critically important for optimal health. The best way to ensure adequate levels of gamma-linolenic acid is to watch the type of fat you eat and follow a zone-favorable diet. To fully play its part in the production of eicosanoids, gamma-linolenic acid must be converted to another fatty acid called dihomo-gamma-linolenic acid, or DGLA. It's only with DGLA that the production of good and bad eicosanoids begins in earnest. The eicosanoid flow separates into two branches. In one branch, DGLA becomes the building block of good eicosanoids like PGE1. In the other branch, DGLA is converted by another enzyme into yet another activated essential fatty acid, arachidonic acid. Excess arachidonic acid is your worst biological nightmare. It's the building block for bad eicosanoids, including thromboxane A2, PGE2, and leukotrienes. The balance of DGLA to arachidonic acid in every cell in the body determines whether or not good or bad eicosanoids are made when the cell is stimulated by its external environment. But hold on, there's more. That is another fatty acid called eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA. Why is EPA so important? Because it inhibits the activity of the enzyme that makes arachidonic acid. Where do you find EPA? In fish. Now let's put all this together. To reach the zone and reap its health and performance rewards, you want to stack the eicosanoid deck in your favor. You want to ensure your cells produce more good eicosanoids than bad ones. How do you do that? By tilting the balance of DGLA to arachidonic acid in your favor. As I said earlier, the most consistent way to achieve this goal is to maintain the appropriate balance between your constant hormonal companions, insulin and glucagon. Too much insulin increases the activity of the enzyme, triggering the increased production of arachidonic acid and bad eicosanoids. Glucagon, on the other hand, decreases the activity of the enzyme, This means that more and more DGLA piles up in the cell membrane, while at the same time, the production of arachidonic acid goes down. But keep in mind, you're only hormonally as good as your last meal. For the past 40 years, Americans have been engaged in a life and death struggle with heart disease. Yet the tragic truth is that heart disease remains by far the number one killer of adults in this country. While rates of death from cardiovascular disease have decreased, the number of heart attacks hasn't changed dramatically. So, if we're really not making that much progress in conquering heart disease, the next question, obviously, is why not? Here's a large part of the answer. The way we're told to eat may be extremely hazardous to a healthy heart. This is especially true of diets that emphasize eating small quantities of fat and protein and large amounts of carbohydrates, especially pasta. All efforts to deal with heart disease in this country are based upon diagnosis and treatment of risk factors, obesity, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. For the past 20 years, scientific evidence has been accumulating to suggest that hyperinsulinemia is the risk factor that best predicts the likelihood of an eventual heart attack. What's the connection between heart disease and the standard risk factors and hyperinsulinemia? The answer is an overproduction of bad eicosanoids. Remember that insulin increases the production of eicosanoids. So the higher your blood insulin levels, the more bad eicosanoids your body produces. As we've seen, too much carbohydrate means an overproduction of insulin. This disturbance in the normal eicosanoid balance is the primary molecular cause of heart disease. So here's an equation you should memorize if you're concerned about heart attacks. High carbohydrate diet equals more bad eicosanoids equals increased incidence of heart attacks. Millions of Americans also suffer from high blood pressure, known as hypertension. It occurs when the body makes more bad eicosanoids than good ones. So if bad eicosanoids can promote hypertension, is there any evidence that good eicosanoids can reduce it? The answer is yes. One of the best known and most studied of the good eicosanoids is prostaglandin E1, also known as PGE1. PGE1 helps put the clamps on the secretion of insulin, and that in turn helps limit the production of bad eicosanoids. Good eicosanoids also promote vasodilation, in which blood vessels actually widen. The combined result? Blood pressure goes down, and so does the risk of heart disease. Reduce your cholesterol and be free of heart disease. That's been the battle cry for the war on heart disease. But the one question no one seems to have asked is, if cholesterol is such a villain, why does the body make so much of it? The truth is, cholesterol is essential for life. It's the primary structural component of every cell in the body. Cholesterol is also the building block for every steroid hormone known to man. Without cholesterol, a great number of your hormonal control systems would immediately grind to a halt. The bottom line is that you need cholesterol to survive. Decreasing its levels too much may have devastating consequences. Of course, the strong consensus of the medical community is that too much cholesterol has the same effect. It increases overall mortality. Therefore, reducing cholesterol levels should reduce mortality. From an examination of the studies, cholesterol-lowering drugs appear to be a questionable way to reduce overall mortality from heart disease. But what about cholesterol-lowering diets? Over a 20-year period, only one of six studies showed any decrease in cardiovascular mortality with cholesterol lowered by the diet. But even in that study, there was no reduction in overall mortality. Even so, Many experts will tell you that the way to lower cholesterol is simply to avoid it in your diet. Unfortunately, the amount of cholesterol you eat has a relatively low impact on the amount of cholesterol in your bloodstream. The truth is that more than 80% of your daily cholesterol production comes from your own liver. And what causes the liver to overproduce cholesterol? High levels of insulin. No wonder that dietary intervention to reduce cholesterol rarely seems to work. The battle against the fourth major risk factor, obesity and its all-too-frequent outcome, type 2 diabetes, has been a totally lost cause. If you have abdominal obesity, your risk for a heart attack is dramatically increased. Why? Because abdominal obesity is a dead giveaway. You almost certainly have elevated levels of insulin. And remember, hyperinsulinemia is the primary risk factor for heart attacks. Hyperinsulinemia is also the clinical definition of type 2 diabetes. The best way to treat type 2 diabetes and the hyperinsulinemia that causes it is to reduce excess body fat. Since the accumulation of excess body fat is caused by hyperinsulinemia, then reduction of excess body fat should decrease insulin resistance and reduce circulating insulin levels. And it does. Yet one of the greatest failures of 20th century cardiovascular medicine is its inability to find a way to reduce excess body fat and keep it off. Diet should be the desired method, but diets have continually failed. Why? Because the recommended dietary programs for cardiovascular patients and for people trying to lose excess body fat in general are in constant violation of the rules needed to reach the zone. Smoking and drinking are among the best-known behavioral risk factors that impact heart disease. Let's look at smoking first. The act of smoking generates a tremendous increase of free radicals. You'll remember that free radicals deplete the body's natural reserves of antioxidants, and this in turn exposes the essential fatty acids that are the building blocks of eicosanoids to free radical destruction. There's also recent research indicating that smoking is associated with an increase in insulin resistance. What about alcohol? In moderate amounts, alcohol actually increases the production of good eicosanoids. This increase in good eicosanoids brings a subsequent decrease in platelet aggregation, the primary event in a heart attack. You have to be careful, though. Higher amounts of alcohol increase the production of bad eicosanoids. So how much alcohol is moderate? About 1 glass of wine per day. Up to now, I've talked about factors that increase your risk for heart disease. But in most cases, the actual trigger of heart attack is the failure of blood flow to the heart due to a blocked artery. Platelet aggregation is the clumping together of circulating platelets in the bloodstream to form clots. If the clot is large enough, it can clog an artery entirely. What causes platelets to clot? Bad eicosanoids. More insidious and more difficult to treat is atherosclerosis, the narrowing and hardening of the arteries caused by a buildup of fatty deposits known as plaques. Theoretically, there are two ways to accomplish reversal of atherosclerosis: drugs and diet. In 1994, researchers published a study in which a combination of diet and the newest cholesterol-lowering drug were used to try to achieve regression of atherosclerotic lesions. Although the patients treated this way did show a small decrease in blockage, there was no change in clinical outcome after 4 years of treatment. The same is true of purely dietary interventions that reduce fat intake and increase carbohydrate consumption. Now that we've taken a close look at some drug and dietary interventions that probably don't work to prevent overall mortality, let's look at a few interventions that probably do. The first of these is aspirin. Aspirin doesn't lower cholesterol, it doesn't lower blood pressure, it doesn't lower high blood sugar in type 2 diabetics, it doesn't reduce excess body fat, but it works to reduce overall mortality in patients who have already had a heart attack. Although the jury on the daily use of aspirin's effect on overall mortality in a healthy population is still out, the aspirin studies have given a unique insight into the ideal intervention for heart disease. The ideal intervention for heart disease would simply consist of reducing the overproduction of beta-carotenoids while simultaneously increasing the production of good-carotenoids. You can do that with a zone favorable diet. So far, I've made some strong statements about drugs and diet and cardiovascular outcome. Remember, the only statistic that truly counts is mortality. Is the drug or the diet preventing early death or not? From that point of view, as we've seen, most intervention studies have come up short of their promise. In the absence of mortality data, is there anything that indicates that a zone favorable diet would be beneficial for a cardiovascular patient? I believe the answer is yes. My constant theme has been the importance of controlling insulin so as to maintain a favorable carotenoid balance. So the question is, can a zone favorable diet significantly lower insulin levels in cardiovascular patients? In 1994, I conducted a pilot study in collaboration with a respected cardiology group. We enrolled 15 type 2 diabetic patients and randomized them into two groups. One group followed a zone favorable diet, and the other group followed the dietary recommendation of the American Diabetes Association. After 8 weeks, there were already statistically significant differences between the two groups. The patients on a zone favorable diet had large reductions in their fasting insulin. When insulin drops, that usually causes two other heart-healthy events, a drop in triglycerides and a drop in blood pressure. This is exactly what happened in the zone favorable group. These patients on the zone favorable diet got still another benefit. They lost excess body fat. Unfortunately, in the group that followed the American Diabetes Association diet, the results were not as favorable. In this group, insulin levels actually rose, with a corresponding increase in the levels of triglycerides. Equally bad, the patients on the American Diabetes Association diet experienced no weight loss or fat loss. Small wonder that type 2 diabetics following the American Diabetes Association diet rarely get better. Other studies are now appearing that support what we found in our pilot study. For the past 20 years, the medical establishment has been waging a highly publicized war against cancer. This war has spawned an impressive array of cancer-fighting weapons, including surgery, radiation, and anti-cancer drugs. The sad truth is, these weapons have had no more than a limited impact. Virtually all the experts acknowledge that a preferred way to treat cancer would be to enlist the patient's own body to fight off the disease, using its own immune system. That's why some of the newest and most promising cancer treatments focus on getting the patient's immune system cranked up to attack cancer. This approach is known as development of biological response modifiers. In my view, the immune system's most important biological response modifier is carcinoids. Frankly, cancer can be understood as a condition in which the carcinoids are out of balance. Beta-carcinoids, as you might imagine, are the villains of the piece, and there's a whole troop of them. PGE2, lipoxins, leukotrienes, and hydroxylated essential fatty acids. Cancer appears to be the result of a runaway production of beta-carcinoids. Think of it this way. Virtually all cancers develop a unique stealth strategy system to make their presence invisible to the immune system. How? By generating an overproduction of bad eicosanoids from arachidonic acid. This gives the cancer cell an extraordinary means of self-protection. It follows then that tilting the body's eicosanoid balance away from bad eicosanoids should have a considerable positive impact on the cancer process. We tilt that balance using the most powerful drug known to man, food. The existing treatments for cancer are probably the most barbaric in modern medicine. Faced with these blunt instruments, many cancer patients search desperately for alternative treatments, often turning to diet. Take macrobiotics, for example. In many ways, a macrobiotic diet is close to a zone favorable diet. First, the macrobiotic diet is low in total fat, so it chokes off supplies of omega-6 essential fatty acids. In that way, it meets the first criteria for a sound anti-cancer diet, low total fat intake. Second, the macrobiotic diet is rich in the activated omega-3 essential fatty acid, EPA. That's because the macrobiotic diet emphasizes fish and sea vegetables. Unfortunately, it's also rich in unfavorable carbohydrates, especially grains. So this violates the third criteria for a sound anti-cancer diet, reduction of insulin levels. Reduction of insulin levels is the fundamental basis of a zone favorable diet. All right, if the macrobiotic diet doesn't quite fit the bill for an anti-cancer diet, what about vegetarian diets? Well, strict vegetarian diets are low in total fat, but that's counterbalanced by an excessive amount of carbohydrates, meaning more insulin and more beta-carcinoids. At the same time, strict vegetarian diets have very limited, if any, amounts of EPA. Finally, there's the American Cancer Society diet. This diet invariably fails for the same reasons that the American Heart Association diet fails. They're both too high in carbohydrates, so they induce excessively high insulin levels. At the same time, the absolute levels of fat are too high. In animals, there are two dietary approaches that have consistently shown to have dramatic anti-cancer effects. One of these approaches is simply to restrict calories. There are two mechanisms by which calorie restriction positively affects cancer. First, calorie restriction reduces insulin levels. Second, since total calories are reduced in these diets, so are total fats. Caloric restriction is not the only approach that's helped fight cancer in animals. An equally successful technique involves feeding the animals high levels of fish oils rich in EPA. Based on the available research, I firmly believe the ideal diet for the cancer patient would have four important features. It would be low in total fat, rich in EPA, have adequate protein to prevent muscle wasting, and control the balance of good and bad eicosanoids by maintaining the proper protein-to-carbohydrate ratio at every meal. These are the fundamentals of a zone-favorable diet. Living in the zone is the best revenge against cancer. Of all the maladies that lay people low, chronic diseases can be frustrating to the point of terror. I've come to think of many of these diseases as either-or conditions. Either you treat them by using a zone-favorable diet, or there's no treatment that's effective in the long run. You see, virtually every disease including many chronic diseases, can be understood in these terms. The body is simply making too many beta-carcinoids and not enough good ones. If that's true, then a zone favorable diet should be helpful in treating any or all of these diseases. Here are some of the chronic diseases that can be attacked with a zone favorable diet. It's a long list, and some of them will surprise you. We really have only one anti-AIDS drug, AZT, and the 1994 International AIDS Conference sadly confirmed that AZT doesn't necessarily prolong the lives of AIDS victims. Sadder still, the outlook for future breakthroughs is not optimistic. The real problem here is that billions of research dollars have been invested in treating AIDS as a purely viral disease. Yet the results from this approach have been lacking. Is it possible that AIDS is not simply a viral disease? As early as 1984, I became convinced that AIDS could be viewed as an carcinoid imbalance disease. The clinical definition of AIDS is the appearance of opportunistic infections that are easily fought off when the immune system is functioning normally. Many of these opportunistic infections associated with AIDS first appeared in the 1950s with the advent of corticosteroids. What happened? Patients developed opportunistic infections similar to those we now see in people with AIDS. How do corticosteroids work in the body? They're like super aspirins. They knock out all carcinoid synthesis. Could the HIV virus be acting like corticosteroids as a massive inhibitor of all carcinoid synthesis? To me, this sounded like a good hypothesis, but it needed testing. I met two physicians whose practice includes a great number of patients infected with HIV who were willing to test the idea. In this study, we used either combinations of activated essential fatty acids or a placebo for the two different groups. One group of people infected with HIV and suffering from chronic fatigue but not taking AZT, and the other group of HIV-infected patients who are taking high doses of AZT. We randomly assigned these patients to take either the activated essential fatty acids or the placebo. After 6 months, we found that the patients on the activated essential fatty acid supplement were dramatically less fatigued than the patients who took only the placebo. All autoimmune diseases can be seen as diseases that result from an imbalance of carcinoids. It's this imbalance, specifically the overproduction of bad carcinoids, that causes the body to attack itself. There are a great number of autoimmune diseases, but probably the most widespread is arthritis. Usually arthritis is treated with anti-inflammatory drugs or corticosteroids. They work by stopping an overproduction of beta-carcinoids. Unfortunately, they also stop good carcinoid production simultaneously. Well, if arthritis is the result of carcinoid imbalance, then the carcinoid modulating benefits of a zone favorable diet should definitely help arthritis sufferers. Numerous clinical studies have shown that dietary supplementation with activated essential fatty acids, such as gamma-linolenic acid and EPA, either singly or in combination, reduces arthritic pain and inflammation. A zone favorable diet should be the first line of defense in the treatment of arthritis. On the other hand, the further from the zone the diet takes the arthritic patient, the more the patient will need those anti-inflammatory drugs to slow down an increasing production of pro-inflammatory carcinoids. The choice seems simple. All of this is strong evidence that a zone favorable diet can be of benefit in treating any type of autoimmune disease. In the zone, all these diseases will improve, simply because a zone favorable diet reduces the overproduction of beta-carotenoids and increases the production of glucocorticoids. The brain, as I mentioned earlier, is mostly fat. It's also exceptionally rich in essential fatty acids. So it should come as no surprise that a number of diseases of the central nervous system can be related to disturbances in a carotenoid balance. Probably the most widely studied of these diseases is alcoholism. In small amounts, alcohol is a boon to the cardiovascular system. It increases the production of glucocorticoids that enhance cardiovascular function. But as we all know, alcohol has a dangerous dark side as well, one of the most dangerous of which is alcoholism. The truth is that alcoholism has a very strong genetic link, suggesting that there may be a genetic predisposition to the disease. What is that link? It turns out that alcoholics have a genetic defect in making gamma-linolenic acid, which ultimately means that their body's ability to make glucocorticoids is compromised. When I begin to work with recovering alcoholics using a zone favorable diet, the first thing they seemed to notice was that their craving for alcohol was greatly reduced, if not completely eliminated. What's the biology behind this happy result? One immediate consequence of a zone favorable diet is the increased production of gamma-linolenic acid. Once normal levels of gamma-linolenic acid are established, so is the normal production of glucocorticoids, so the underlying biological need for alcohol wanes. Alcoholism isn't the only central nervous system disorder that responds to a zone favorable diet. Another is depression. Glucocorticoids have significant antidepressive effects because they increase the uptake and release of neurotransmitters from the nerves. There are usually two causes of chronic pain, and they usually coexist. The first is an actual structural impingement on the nerve fibers themselves. In other words, something's rubbing against the nerves. Obviously, unless the structural problem is taken care of, the pain will be constant. The field of chiropractic and muscle therapy can help relieve pain caused by skeletal or muscle impingement. Since pain is difficult to quantify, claims for the effectiveness of chiropractic and muscle therapy remain unsupported, even though thousands of case studies suggest that these therapies do benefit some patients. I believe that the inconsistency of chiropractic and muscle therapy lies in their failure to address the other cause of chronic pain, the body's overproduction of pain's biochemical mediators, beta-carotenoids. You can stop the production of beta-carotenoids and thus reduce pain by using anti-inflammatory drugs. Or you may need the real heavy hitters of pain relief, corticosteroids. For the chronic pain patient, the long-term use of corticosteroids presents a terrible dilemma. Either risk an immune deficiency condition or suffer continuing pain. Of course, there's a way around this dilemma, following a zone favorable diet. In this section, I presented a long list of chronic diseases, in addition to heart disease and cancer. You can alter carotenoid levels with drugs like aspirin and corticosteroids that knock out carotenoids, or by direct injection of glucocorticoids, or by supplementation with activated essential fatty acids. Each of these strategies can potentially reduce the symptoms associated with the diseases. Diet alone, even a zone favorable diet, is not an alternative to drug therapy, but it will always be a companion. You have to eat. You might as well eat smart. The quest for longer life is as old as life itself. Researchers have already found a way to dramatically lengthen lifespan in animals, and all evidence suggests that what can be done for animals can also be done for humans. What is this magical formula? Very simple. Eat less food. In fact, as long as the animal is supplied with all the essential nutrients it needs, caloric intake can be cut by as much as 40%. Not only will the animal live longer, but it will be healthier, less vulnerable to disease and to the ravages of aging. Even so, researchers who have been conducting dietary restriction experiments have been thinking calorically, not hormonally. Actually, it should be fairly easy to do a controlled life extension experiment in humans, as long as you use a zone favorable diet. Once a person reaches the zone, he or she doesn't need as many calories to stay there. You don't have to wait a lifetime to gain the benefits of a zone favorable diet. In 2 weeks, you'll have less hunger, freedom from carbohydrate cravings, greater mental focus, and greater physical performance. A zone favorable diet is not a starvation diet, it's a hormonally correct diet. Reducing calories and carbohydrates will decrease insulin production and the corresponding overproduction of bad eicosanoids. I believe that this is the real key to the superior health and longevity found in animals undergoing calorie restriction. That's not all. Remember that with lower levels of insulin, the size and mass of fat cells actually shrinks. On consistent calorie-restricted diets, there are no fat rats. On a consistent zone-favorable diet, there are no fat humans. The heart gets other rewards as well. Calorie restriction reduces blood pressure, which diminishes the risk of heart attack and strokes. This is exactly what happens when you reach the zone and stay there over time. Meanwhile, long-term underfeeding significantly lowers blood levels of cholesterol and triglycerides. All this leads me to believe that for humans, a zone-favorable diet should also be viewed as an anti-aging diet. Underlying all this is an inescapable conclusion. Dietary restriction may actually be helping the body to produce more good eicosanoids than bad ones. In fact, as I've said, a zone-favorable diet is a calorie-restricted diet. A zone-favorable diet simply puts calorie restriction on automatic pilot, because the zone-favorable diet controls insulin, glucagon, and eicosanoids. You simply won't need to eat as much. You'll still get all the essential nutrients you need. Another benefit of being in the zone is that your needs for sleep will decrease by 1 or 2 hours per day. Immediate life extension, the easy way. Of course, long life without good health is not a blessing, but a burden. The key is maintaining good health and maximum vitality even in old age. Dietary restriction does that in lab animals. Despite the fact that they live longer, the animals are actually less susceptible to diseases than their eat-all-you-want relatives. I think that if you follow the nutritional prescriptions I give you, you'll get exactly the same benefits: long life, increased vitality, and perhaps, most important, the greatest gift of all, good health. It's all possible in the zone. Optimal health means maximizing the quality of your life. Your goal may not be to reach the maximum human lifespan of 115 years, but to squeeze every bit out of life within your allotted time on this planet. I've tried to give you some of the rules and some of the tools I have developed to plot your own course to the zone, but only you can actually start to use them. As I tell everyone, I don't care if it's a drug, a diet, a vitamin, or a mineral. If you try any new program for 2 weeks and you don't see a significant difference in how you feel, then it probably isn't going to happen. Following a zone favorable diet is no different. All you have to give is 2 weeks of your time. Through my own understanding of eicosanoids, I now hold my own fate in my hands. I hope you will too.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.